This is the Publish Radio. You're listening to The Weekly Catch. I'm Luis Hernandez. Earlier this month, Rhode Island lawmakers finally passed a bill aimed at ending the predatory practices of payday lenders. We'll look at what the new law means and how it took 15 years to get it passed. Also, our reporting on underage, undocumented children working in New Bedford fishing houses has at least one Massachusetts lawmaker looking at ways to end the practice. Our reporter Ben Burke will describe what he's found and the response from the fishing industry. And on Artscape, a conversation about the fusion of Afro-Cuban, Puerto Rican, and New Orleans jazz. That and more on this episode of The Weekly Catch. For years, cash-strapped Rhode Islanders in need of quick money have been able to seek financial loans from payday lenders. Incredibly high interest rates and fees charged by the lenders often force borrowers into never-ending cycles of increasing debt. Such predatory practices have prompted a new state law that places a cap on payday lending rates. Here to talk more about it is reporter Nancy Lavin, who's been covering the story for the Rhode Island Current. Nancy, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, payday lending loans, small loan linked to your paycheck, supposed to help people who are a little behind on bills, controversial because of these high rates, interest over 200% in some cases. How big of a problem is this in Rhode Island?
This is a longstanding issue that has been brought up in the State House for at least 15 years running. So certainly the length of time suggests that this is a significant problem for the people it affects, being charged up to 360% interest in fees on these short-term loans that they have to repay or refinance every 13 days. So just one day short of a typical paycheck cycle, which, you know, proponents for the reform advocate really traps borrowers in this cycle of debt that they just can't escape and probably don't really realize when they're signing up for these original loans.
Do we know how many Rhode Islanders have taken out or usually take out these kind of loans?
We don't have the most up-to-date data. However, in 2022, which was the most recent data available by the Center for Responsible Lending, which is a research and advocacy organization, borrowers in total took out 80,000 loans, totaling $28.2 million of money borrowed. And of that, they paid an estimated $2.8 million in interest and fees. The data doesn't show what percentage of Rhode Islanders or the number that took out the loans. So, you know, those 80,000 loans could be repeat borrowers. It's not necessarily 80,000 borrowers, but the data definitely suggests that the amount of interest and fees being paid on these small dollar short-term loans is very high and is not, you know, what would be allowed in any other sort of typical financial institution lending situation.
Nancy, I'm thinking about those interest rates you mentioned. How long does it usually take for a person to pay back these loans?
So obviously it varies, but there is some data that suggests that the average cycle of repayment that it will take, I think it's 13 refinances or sort of additional interest accrued for a borrower to repay these small dollar loans, because obviously the people who are taking out these loans are in, you know, kind of significant financial emergency. And even if they get that next paycheck, they don't necessarily have that money to devote to paying back that loan and the interest and fees in addition to rent or groceries or whatever else. So it takes a significant amount of time.
So Nancy, if I'm doing my math correct, let's say a person takes out a loan, $500, they're refinancing, you said almost up to 13 times. So is it taking 5-6 months or more to pay these back?
Yes, nationally, at least, research by Pew Charitable Trust, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, shows that the average payday loan borrower is in debt for about 5 or 6 months out of the year, and that 4 out of 5 payday loans are renewed or rolled over within that 13-day repayment each time. So this is a short-term fix that becomes a long-term problem.
Who is the typical customer for these loans? What groups were taking out these loans?
Nationally, the data suggests that it is a lot of, you know, lower income families and residents, also disproportionately people of color. So again, the idea that these are predatory loans preying upon people who also in some cases don't have access to traditional financial institutions. So maybe because they don't have a good credit score or some other financial issues, they can't get a loan from a traditional bank, and they see this as an alternate option, maybe to help them, but potentially creating more problems down the line.
And what happens to somebody if they get trapped in these loans?
It's definitely a possibility that, you know, you owe money to a lending institution, and at some point when you aren't able to pay back the original loan and all of the interest and fees, there are going to be other consequences in terms of your possessions and your financial assets. It should be noted that the new law has been signed, but it doesn't go into effect until January 1st, 2027. So this is going to not be erased right away. But under the existing loophole, they can pay up to 360% annual interest and fees on these loans versus the 36% cap that the federal government has instituted, 22 other states have instituted, and as of January 1st, 2027, will also be sort of the ceiling in Rhode Island.
You mentioned other states have already passed this. Why did it take so long in Rhode Island? You said almost 15 years. Why did it take so long?
That depends upon whom you ask, but most advocates would say that the biggest block to that in recent history was the late Senate President Dominic Ruggiero, who, like other sort of critics, worried that, you know, this is a good flexible option for some people, and to get rid of this option could have bad consequences for people who are unbanked and don't have access to traditional financial institutions. Every year since Ruggiero was the Senate president, this bill has not advanced out of committee in the Senate to even get to the floor. And it is widely believed that is because he would not allow it to, even though it would pass in the Senate.
But it doesn't go into effect until 2027. Why the delay? Why not now?
Originally, the law was supposed to go into effect immediately. And the delay was sort of a compromise, both for the affected institutions, but also, according to the bill sponsors, for their employees. There are, I think, 8 storefronts that Advance America operates in Rhode Island doing payday lending operations. The bill doesn't say they have to go out of existence, but it's sort of assumed that because they won't be able to profit off of this kind of scheme where they can charge much more in interest and fees than a traditional lending institution, these storefronts will probably close, which will mean, you know, vacant real estate, which is already an issue in the commercial real estate industry, and then also that their employees would lose their jobs. So the delay is supposed to give the employees time to find new jobs, the, you know, strip mall landlords time to find new tenants for those properties.
Are there alternatives for people? Because I'd imagine there's still going to be Rhode Islanders who have that emergency need. They have to pay a bill right now and they can't wait for the next paycheck. Are there alternatives for them moving forward after these companies have probably left?
Yes. And that has been a big point of proponents, is that in addition to traditional financial lending institutions, there are a pretty strong network of sort of alternative, you know, community development institutions, including the Capital Good Fund, which is now in multiple states, but was started in Rhode Island specifically for the purpose of providing short-term, small-dollar loans, and in addition to other types of financing for people who might struggle to qualify under traditional banking institution regulations.
I've been speaking with Nancy Lavin, reporter for the Rhode Island Current. Nancy, always appreciate the insight. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more from The Weekly Catch after this break. This is The Publix Radio. I'm Luis Hernandez. You're listening to The Weekly Catch. A 2023 investigative series by The Publix Radio revealed some seafood processing factories in Massachusetts illegally employed migrant teenagers. They worked overnight shifts and operated powerful machines, killing crabs and stripping the skin and bones off fish fillets. The series chronicled the lives of kids as young as 14 who worked until early in the morning, sleeping for just an hour or two, before then going to high school. Massachusetts lawmakers are now taking action in response to what the series uncovered. Our reporter Ben Burke has been covering the latest developments, and he joins me now. Ben, thanks so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, our newsroom worked so hard on these stories. I'm glad to be here talking about it.
Ben, our reporting on this story is shaking things up. Something happened. What's going on?
Yeah, the lawmakers in New Bedford, the state legislators in New Bedford, responded to our reporting and wrote a bill because they are trying to end child labor in New Bedford's fish houses. So, you know, they had a hearing at the state house for this bill, and the lawmaker who's the lead sponsor thanked us for exposing the issue in his comments before the Judiciary Committee.
And what exactly is the bill going to do?
The bill does two things. For a long time, it was sort of a legal gray area whether or not kids under 18 could work legally in the fish houses. So it was like under certain circumstances and certain tasks, it seemed like maybe it's legal for them to do that. This bill definitively makes it illegal for anyone under 18 to work in seafood processing or seafood packing. The other thing the bill does, which the bill's authors think is the most important thing that it does, it raises the fines significantly for child labor violations. So before, if a company was caught employing a minor in an inappropriate position, the fines were almost nothing. The minimum fine was $500, okay? This bill will raise the minimum fine to $20,000 for the first violation. And then the fines escalate if there's additional violations. So if a seafood processing company is found to have employed minors, you know, three times, you know, that third violation would be a $100,000 fine.
I'm going back to the original reporting that we did for the series, Underage and Unprotected. And I think about the fact that, you know, these boys had to work. They needed the work. And I'm wondering if this becomes law and they can't anymore, what exactly are they going to do?
I spoke with a social worker who's in regular contact with these migrant teenagers. And she said that she thinks they're just going to go to other cities, you know, other places where these child labor practices haven't been exposed yet. And so there still are back doors into jobs that will give them hours and the pay that they want. The hope, right, is that they would stay put in New Bedford and go get kind of like a safe teenage job, like working in an ice cream shop or doing some landscaping or something like that. But the trouble is these teenagers want a lot of hours. They want as many hours as they can get, like the way an adult would, which is not typical of a teenage job. And the other issue is they don't have work authorization from the federal government. In a lot of cases, they've turned themselves in at the border. So the government's aware that they're here. They're allowing them to be here, but they're not allowing them to work. And so what these kids have to do is they can't go to the ice cream shop and apply because they don't have a social security number that lets them work. They have to go in through this back door if they want to work. And, you know, what kind of jobs are letting people in the back door under the table? They tend to be, you know, the toughest jobs that Americans don't want.
Ben, you're telling me these kids need to work. It's more than that. It's not just they need a job. There's a lot more going on here.
It's such a different economic situation that, you know, being 14 or 15 in those countries means something really different than it does to mean to be 14 or 15 here. You know, these kids are expected to contribute financially to the family, to support the families. It's not considered too young to have to leave school and do that. More specifically, they also pick up some serious debt on their way to the United States to get the jobs to support their families, okay? A lot of these kids come up here with coyotes or smugglers who traffic in a very dangerous trade and can sometimes use violence to collect their debts. So, you know, once these kids get to the U.S., if they don't pay off that debt to the coyote or the smuggler, I mean, their families could be in fatal danger.
How are they ending up in these places? How are they ending up at you know, the fish houses?
Yeah, that's an important question because I don't want to give people the wrong idea about why and how they're getting hired. It's not like the seafood processing companies in New Bedford are so desperate for labor that they want to employ 14 and 15-year-olds. Like, these companies do not want to be employing kids because it's a huge legal liability for them. It looks bad. It feels bad. It's just It's just not in their interest to be hiring kids. What's happening is these kids are supplying fake documents, you know, fake birth certificates, fake social security numbers to temporary staffing agencies in New Bedford who are supposed to do the screening and figure out that these documents are fake and theoretically turn away, you know, undocumented people and only employ people legally in these jobs. But, you know, it's more complicated than you might think to actually spot these forgeries. And there's also a question of whether or not these staffing agencies exist to sort of be a permissive boundary that lets some of these people in and insulates the companies themselves from the legal liability of having broken the law.
From our reporting, but also now from the fact that you have lawmakers at least even discussing potential bills to make this illegal, have we heard from the industry, from the fish houses? And, you know, have they said anything about the fact that, wait a minute, we're doing this? We're hiring these kids? What are they saying?
This is the kind of story where nobody really wants to be on the record. So it's not like I could go in the front door of the seafood processing plant and talk to a local owner and get his or her real feelings on the issue, right? In this case, we had to go through an intermediary. His name's Bob Vanass. He really knows the seafood industry well. He knows what's going on offshore. He knows what's going on offshore, onshore. He's connected to lots of people in the industry. And so he was sort of the person that we use to represent the industry's perspective. And I really do trust his perspective on this. So Bob talked to a lot of seafood processing owners about the bill, and he said that they are convinced that they're basically being punished for having been defrauded. You know, these seafood companies, from their perspective, are not trying to hire kids. They're being tricked into hiring kids with fake documents. And now that there's legislation being considered, they feel like they're going to be fined extensively for somehow not being able to catch these kids.
Is there anything that you found in your reporting that wasn't in the story? Maybe there's something else that we missed or something else that we haven't heard yet?
Yeah. So, I mean, this story was about the legislative response to the revelations that there are young teenagers who have worked in New Bedford's fish processing plants, right? But the other really important thing that's happened since the reporting came out is that there are federal investigations into these allegations of child labor that are unfolding. And it's been really hard to track down information from the Department of Labor under Trump about whether these investigations are really continuing. I've spoken to a lot of people on background and off the record. And what I'm hearing is that a lot of the work that was happening on these investigations has come to a halt. You know, there were people in New Bedford who were in regular contact with federal investigators trying to get to the bottom of how extensive this child labor issue is in New Bedford. And those people haven't heard from federal investigators since Trump took office, basically. So that didn't make it into the story, and that's a really important thing that we're going to continue to report on. We're going to be trying to figure out what actually came of these federal investigations, and are they still being pursued seriously?
I've been speaking with the Publix Radio reporter, Ben Burke. Ben, as always, thanks so much for your reporting and for taking the time to break it down for me. Thank you.
Yeah, Lewis, thanks for listening to the piece and having a thoughtful conversation with me about it.
You can see more of our reporting on the seafood processing industry in New Bedford at thepublicsradio.org. We'll be back with more from The Weekly Catch in just a moment. This is The Weekly Catch. I'm Luis Hernandez, and it's time for Artscape. The First Works Summer Beats Concert Series takes place at Roger Williams Park this summer with a variety of acts performing at the Boathouse Lawn every other week. Tonight, you can see the William Cepeda and Elio Villafranca Jazz Sextet in a performance called Merging Roots. It's a collaboration exploring the shared African roots between Cuba, Puerto Rico, and New Orleans. I spoke with both musicians for this week's show. Elio, let me ask you this. How do you describe the Puerto Rican sound, the Cuban jazz? You know, what are those differences?
You know, my background, my upbringing is Congolese tradition. I grew up in a very small town called San Luis in Pina del Rio in Cuba, where they do this tradition, this called tambor yuca, which is very, very rare form of drumming that came from the Congolese tradition. And the reason why I mentioned this is because the Congolese tradition and the bomba tradition, they're very related. They're cousins. I wanted to actually address the larger root of this music, which was seen more as a Caribbean music, not just Cuban music. Then I started creating all this project that actually embraces not just the Cuban music, but embraces Puerto Rican music. And a lot of my albums, like, for example, Caribbean Tinge. I have a record called Caribbean Tinge, which speaks about all the, for example, the Jelly Roll Morton takes of the Spanish tinge that he called a Spanish tinge. I'd say it was supposed to be Caribbean tinge because the rhythm that he used to create his Spanish tinge were a Caribbean product, wasn't a Spanish product. But he learned from the habanera from a Spanish composer, so that's the reason why he called it the Spanish tinge. But the Spanish composer learned the rhythm of the habanera in Cuba and the Caribbean, and so you know, start making the case of how Caribbean music is really important in the foundation of jazz.
I want to get a sense from both of you. The show that's coming up is, what can we expect? And, you know, will we hear that difference? Like, wait a minute, now I'm getting the Cuban, now I'm getting the more Puerto Rican, I'm getting more different style, Brazilian maybe. You know, Ellie, I'll start with you, but I want to hear, William, from you as well. When I hear the show, how am I going to experience it? What are you going to do?
Right now, it's a work in progress. In a sense, like, it's all, like, cooking in my head, on our head. Like, for this particular project, I looked at a music that I haven't actually looked before, which is called Bambula, which is a rhythm that kind of like ties and connects New Orleans with Puerto Rico and Cuba, because it's a rhythmic formula that actually is present in many of the traditions that we do. And also, I'm writing a song, because I mean, this project is also to celebrate New Orleans music and to celebrate the Neville Brothers. It's very, very New Orleans, kind of like, in a sense. So, and I wanted to capture that. And then in the music that I'm writing, I'm incorporating elements of that with elements of Puerto Rican bomba and elements of Cuban rhythm, like song. And I'm experimenting at this point with how I envision the music for this project from my end.
All right. And William, for you, what are you bringing?
Basically, the project, Merging Roots, is about merging roots from Cuba, from Puerto Rico, and from New Orleans. Also, you know, New Orleans have a lot of influence from the Caribbean too, from Haiti, from a lot of different places. And also, during the interpretation of one of the songs from the Nevins Brothers, Fire in the Bow. So I'm doing that one also. I'm doing a version of that tune, my own version, including mixing with the Puerto Rican and the different Caribbean to that tune.
I've been talking with William Cepeda and Elio Villafranca. Their jazz sextet is performing on Friday at the Dalrymple Boathouse Lawn in Roger Williams Park at 6 p.m. with an artist talk beforehand at 5 p.m. William, Elio, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure too.
Artscape producer James Baumgartner joins me now with a few recommendations for the week ahead. James, what's going on?
Well, the Providence Fringe starts next week. There's an opening party on Sunday, but the performances begin on Tuesday, the 15th, and continue through Saturday, the 26th. Fringe is really a place for experimentation. There are dozens of shows happening in this two-week period with a real range. There's one-person introspective plays, contemporary dance, stand-up comedy, and genderqueer juggling unicyclists. There are also special events like a mixer for artists and another for playwrights. There's dance classes and a few family-friendly shows as well. That's Fringe PVD, July 13th through the 26th at venues in the Valley and Olneyville neighborhoods of Providence. All of the information is at fringepvd.org. You can see the Newport Dance Festival next week as well. The performances are on Wednesday, July 16th through Sunday the 20th. The Newport Contemporary Ballet is performing, as well as a variety of visiting dance companies showcasing so many different styles. The performances are on the lawn of the Great Friends Meeting House in Newport. Again, that's July 16th through the 20th. And there's a couple of dreamy folk pop artists playing in Westerly on Sunday. You can see Natalie Jane Hill opening for Twain at Donlands in Westerly. Donlands is sometimes an art gallery, sometimes a performance space. Looks like a great place to see a relaxing Sunday evening show. An evening with Twain and Natalie Jane Hill starts at 7 p.m.
A lot of great stuff. Thank you, James.
Thanks, Lewis.
We'll end our show with music from Twain. The Weekly Catch will be taking a break, so this is the last episode you'll hear for a while. In the meantime, we'll still bring you stories and conversations that are important to you here in Rhode Island and southeastern Massachusetts. You'll hear them throughout the week on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and online at thepublicradio.org. That's it for our show. The Weekly Catch is a production of The Public Radio. Our assistant producer is Joe Tasca. Our producer is James Baumgartner. Our editor is Murray Valindo. Our chief content officer, Sally Isley. And our president and CEO is Pam Johnston. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening.
Walk down Telegraph on the angel's path. Hallelujah. As my father would say, if you love something, set it free.